give your word. Spread the word. Mark my words. Love the words. On East Leeds Community Radio.
Nothing compares to its song.
So good afternoon, you're listening to Love the Words here on East Leeds Community Radio from Studio One of Chapel FM Arts Centre. And that was, believe it or not, The Beatles, a track chosen by our guest this afternoon, the poet David Harmer. So hello, David.
Hi. Hello.
And I'm going to be asking you about that track and why you chose it in just a minute. But first of all, I'm going to introduce our second guest, who actually wasn't supposed to be here today. He came for a meeting that isn't today. But I thought it's the opportunity is there and it's too good to miss. So we've got Stu Hennigan.
Hiya, Peter. It's an unexpected treat.
So, no, it's great to have you here. And Stu is works for Leeds Libraries, but also is the writer of Ghost Signs, which is a book in our local writer's library through there. It's received a lot of acclaim when it came out. And, yeah, it's fantastic to have him back. So, David, yeah first of all, before you read a poem, because you're poised to do so.
I'm poised.
tell us about that track and why you chose it.
Because the first poem I remember ever writing was when I was at Bromley Boys Grammar School. Of course, I used to live down in the south, and I used to... Well, there's two ways to pronounce it. You can go to Bromley Boys Grammar School, but I went to Bromley Boys Grammar School. And we had this wonderful English teacher who used to read us all these marvellous poems by people who then would have been like R.S. Thomas, who would have been a contemporary, I guess, then. And he encouraged us to write little poems, and I wrote a little poem, probably about jackdaws. And it was 1963, and that's the first time. And that song was one of the first records I ever bought. Fantastic. No, well, I didn't. My mum and dad bought it for me, you know.
It was probably five and six, wasn't it?
Six and threepence.
Six and threepence. we can go back and check that. But was that Mr. Moore, the teacher?
Oh, no, the legendary Mr. Moore, who probably... No, Mr. Moore was my head teacher at one of my many primary schools, who used to terrify me.
I was skimming your website now. No, reading it in detail, of course.
Reading it in detail. Yeah, yeah. The website I didn't know was still there. I haven't paid any money into that for years, but it's nice to... It's good to know it's still out there.
But this teacher obviously was very forced.
Yeah, he was great. Side. Yeah, he was. He was... he was called Mr. Spears. He was from New Zealand. I mean, I thought he was about 95, but obviously he was a very young guy. And he's on some kind of exchange scheme or something, was he? He'd come over to Bromley. Yeah. And he'd read us all these wonderful poems, which stayed with me to today.
And do you think he started you off with poetry?
Yeah, well, that and having a mother who was Welsh. Well, and so Dylan Thomas was like the third person in the house.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, since you are poised. For poems, let's hear one. This is what you've written a lot for children.
I do write a lot for children.
And
yes,
for young people. I'm really interested to hear about that.
Okay.
And about your, how you get children into writing, into poetry, rather like Mr. Spears did with you. But let's hear a poem.
Okay, well, this is a poem called All Kinds of Kids. And I haven't switched my phone off. And it just went bing.
No, I did tell you, didn't I?
The batty and the chatty and the scatty and the catty and the dippy and the lippy and the gobby and the snobby and the loopy and the droopy and the soppy and the floppy, the feared and revered, the one with a beard. The ones who run in races, the ones who pull daft faces, the smiley and the wily and the pretty and the gritty and the ones who jump about, the ones who like to shout, the squirmers and the squigglers, the weirdos and the gigglers and the braggers, the boasters, the clever make the mosters, the surly and the twirly, the girly and the burly, the ones who chew their nails, the ones who tell big tales, the ones who save their dosh, the ones who talk dead posh, the fizzy and the dizzy, the bossy and the busy, the snidey and the snotty, the ones who are a beauty, the cool and the cooler, the fooled and the fooler, the posers and the liars, the buster gut triers, the grotty and the snotty, the nerdy and the wordy, the dreamy and the screamy, the ones who make you weary, the ones who talk like crazy, the ones who are quite lazy, the ones we all adore, the ones who are a bore, the wary and the scary and the freaky and the geeky and the cheery and the sneery and the stinky and the slinky, the spotty and the dotty, the lumpy and the grumpy, the ones who like to natter, the ones with chat up patter, all kinds of kids, everyone unique, everyone matters, every day and every week, gotta help each other, gotta pull through, don't care if you don't like it, it's what you gotta do.
Excellent. Thank you very much, right. David.
I'm going to switch my phone off.
Yeah, you can. I'll give you a minute to do that, or even a few seconds.
Yeah, cool.
Well, where was that from?
Oh, that was from, well, as you ask, it was from my latest book, published in 2021. It's called All Kinds of Poems for All Kinds of Kids, and it comes from, well, the best known as Smith Doorstop, who do a lot of grown-up stuff, but when they do kids stuff, they call themselves Small Donkey. So it's Peter and Anne Sampson, who do the poetry business in Sheffield, and they asked me to write. They're not all new. I mean, it's like all these books, there's quite a lot of old ones in there as well, but yeah, some new ones too. And that's what it's called. It's called All Kinds of Poems for All Kinds of Kids.
I didn't even know that they had a small person's.
They don't have. There's not many of us on it. No.
Great. Well, since we've got Stu here, Stu, did you have an equivalent to Mr. Spears at school, or did you discover writing poetry words elsewhere?
It's strange that you mentioned Dylan Thomas, actually, because poetry and stuff didn't kind of register in my house when I was a kid. Like, my dad left school when he was 13. He's read one book in his life, which was mine. But I was listening to the Mark Radcliffe Show on Radio 1 when I was about 13, and I had a poet poet called Jules Denby, who's from Bradford, I think.
Yeah.
And she was reading Dylan Thomas, and she read Fern Hill.
Yeah.
I remember the end of that, as I was young and easy in the mercy of his means, time held me green and dying, I was singing my chains like the sea. And I was just like, wow, I didn't know you could do that with words.
Yeah.
If you can do that with words, I want to do that with words. And I've been kind of trying and failing to do it ever since.
Well, only Dylan could do Dylan.
Only you could do that. Yeah. You can't imitate it, can you? But that was the one that started it for me. And I read that to my kids, and you know, they're getting into that stuff too now, so it's nice to kind of pass it down.
It is a bit difficult when you're a young writer, when you're writing in your early 20s, like what I was, and you catch Dylan Thomas.
Oh, gosh,
and it's really difficult to get rid of Dylan Thomas. Yes. I remember I was on an exchange scheme when I was a student. I was at Penn State University in 1971, and you could do writing courses because they had a degree in writing like they have at Hallam now. And the teacher took me to one side and he said, "Kid, will you stop reading Dylan or expletive Thomas? You kids is all the same. It's either that or E.E. Cummings. Stop it."
Yeah, yeah. Or there's an equivalent as well, which is catching T.S. Eliot.
Yeah.
I had T.S. Eliot quite
badly. Did you?
Yeah, very bad. I had four quartets for a long time. It brings you out in all sorts.
It confuses you about whether it's time present or time's future.
Absolutely, yeah.
Or time's tables.
But David, yes, you were in the original Circus of Poets, I believe.
Well, I didn't think there was another one. God, there isn't a copy band out there, isn't there? Called the Circuit of Poets. Yes, I was in Circus of Poets with Ian McMillan, the late great Martin Whaley, and John Turner. Yeah,
I didn't know that. And I knew there were four of you. They must have been good old times.
They were great. Yeah, I'd never done anything like that before. I went along to a workshop in Wath-upon-Dearne, and there they all were. It was run by a poet called Kit Wright, who was a fantastic, wonderful, marvellous writer, and the late Pete Morgan. And these three young men were there, and they said, "Well, would you like to?" And I can't sing, or you talked about being in a band. I can't do anything like that. I'm one of those people. When I start singing, people leave the room. So we just started writing performance poetry, and it was quite a political time as well, so we could get good and angry.
So when are we talking now?
What time? 84, 5, 6, into the early 90s.
Yeah. That was...
And then I formed a duo with my friend Paul Cookson, who's still out there, doing the schools. And we call ourselves Spill the Beans. And now I'm in an elderly gentleman's duo called the Glummer Twins. Which, right, you have to be over 60 to get most of the gags.
You've done a gig here.
Yeah, the Glummer Twins did a gig here. We do it again if you want. But
I enjoyed the last one.
No, seriously, yeah, we did a gig here, I think. Yeah, over the radio.
Absolutely. Mm. So, but you went as a so-called proper job, you went into teaching.
Yeah. Yes, I worked in primary schools, but around about 2003, because I'd spent most of my holidays, weekends, evenings, half terms, working, performing, writing and stuff. So around about 2003, I thought, I want to do this forever. And my wife said, well, go on then. And so I did. And the last job I did was in 2019.
Read us another poem, okay, if you would. Yeah, because you've got a whole stack of books.
Well,
here.
I've got a stack of books. They're all the same poem. It's just they're all in different books. Right. That's how it works. I'm very fond of this one. This one's been printed a lot. It's a very old poem. It's called My Mum Put Me on the Transfer List. And it doesn't rhyme like the last one rhymed a bit, didn't it? On offer, one nippy striker, 10 years old, has scored 7 goals this season. His nifty footwork and big smile knows how to dive in the penalty box, can get filthy and muddy within 2 minutes, guaranteed to wreck his kit each week. This is a free transfer. But he comes with running expenses. Weeks of washing shirts and shorts, socks and vests, a pair of trainers, needs to scoff huge amounts of chips, burgers, beans, apples, pop, cola, crisps and oranges, and endless packets of chewing gum. This offer open until the end of the season. I'll have him back then. At least till the cricket season starts. Any takers?
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, writing for children must, I don't know, what do you need to write well for children, do you think? I mean, this is a question also for Stu, because Stu, you've done a lot of work with children and young people, and you brought, in fact, we'll come to that in a minute, the competition that you kind of oversaw. But yeah, I mean, I'm just wondering if there are children's writers you particularly admire, David, that did it right.
Oh, goodness me, yes. But there's hundreds of them, and there's so many great children's poets out there. I mean, earlier Stu and I were talking about the great Michael Rosen. I mean, he was a bit of a pathfinder for children. Because when I first started teaching all those years ago, there were very few writers who dedicated... There were lots and lots of books for children full of grown-up writers who they thought maybe children might quite like.
Yeah,
like Walter...
Walter de la Mare.
Fantastic. Yeah. I mean, aren't they? Rudyard Kipling, Five and Twenty Ponies, Trotting Through the Dark, and all that stuff.
My boy loves that one.
It's
when
fantastic,
I read that,
isn't it?
That one to
But nobody seemed actually to write just for children. And then a man called John Foster arrived, who, you know John Foster?
I've heard the name.
Yeah, well, he got into working with Corky Paul, the great illustrator we were discussing, and Oxford University Press, and just started producing lots and lots and lots of anthologies for children, which allowed me to... But I don't know, the poems that I read when I was little was The Walrus and the Carpenter and Jabberwocky and all that. So I suppose that got me going.
Well, there are only a certain amount of those, as you say, that are, you know, Lear and Kipling and Walter de la Mare. Is anybody there? Is anybody there? Said the traveller.
Oh,
it's a great. That was the thing that got me going. Actually, the listener. Yeah.
But now there are literally hundreds of out there. People who is it Book Day? Well, Book Day today or
is it?
This week?
Let's pretend it is. And this is very timely.
It's on Thursday. I think.
It's on Thursday. Yes. Thank you. Well, there's just so many much younger than me writers for children who are working in schools up and down the land.
In terms of poetry for children, though, that I don't know that I've never tried it, but I mean, it's what do you need? One could be patronising, I suppose.
Yeah. Okay, I'll try and answer that. I find that a bit difficult. I'll do my best. Okay, when I worked in schools, I worked on the premise that I was their mad uncle. By the end, I was their mad grandfather. And my main objective was to make them laugh like drains till they cried. Because if you can do that, you're going to, you know. And to just be a bit of an icebreaker, to be a bit of a blunt instrument, if you will. So after I'd spent a day in a school, performing in the morning perhaps, and then doing workshops throughout the school, whole class workshops, making huge big poems, leaving things for the teachers to follow up with if they wanted to on an individual basis. I hope maybe something more subtle might come along after me, because there's only so many times you can say, Mr. Moore, creaking down the corridor, you know. So I tried to make them laugh quite a lot, and then every now and then stick in a serious one. But you've got to be a poet. I mean, I've always been a poet, really. It's the only thing I'm much good at, so that kind of helped. But yeah, I think try to make them laugh. And I try to write poems that most young children, I'm talking about primary age, really. That's my speciality, I think. Can either have read to them and they get it, or read for themselves and get it. Mm. I don't want to be one of those grown-up writers who thinks this is for the children and writes a not very good grown-up poem.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does, yes. I was also thinking back to the Dylan conversation just now and about the sort of visceral excitement of words, really. It's so thrilling, isn't it, when children suddenly get a sense of what you can do, rather like you were with Dylan Thomas, that thing, well, if he can do that, maybe I can do that.
Yeah, and it's interesting what you said when you were introducing that question about... kind of patronising in a way. Like I've just read a book to my daughter, who is 9 on Sunday, I think, by Sally Gardner called I, Coriander. Mm. And it's a historical novel. It's set during the time of the English Civil War, but there's like a kind of slightly fantasy-esque plot with it. And it's the best children's book I've ever read.
Really?
And the kind of reason for it is because it doesn't talk down to the audience in the way that some children's books can. I mean, I'm a history nerd, so I could kind of explain bits to her as we were going along. You wouldn't need to know the history to get the book, but the kind of richness of the language in it and the depths of the kind of... There were lots and lots of... allusions to different fairy tales things like that. That again, it's a bit like you can read Ulysses, right, without being well versed in Homer and stuff. There's a lot more in there than just these kind of mythic parallels. And it was kind of like that. You didn't need to spot the fairy tale things or anything. It was just a really, really well told story that didn't make any concessions to the fact it was for a younger audience, and it was incredibly poetic and incredibly descriptive without being flowery and self-indulgent.
That's great.
And I think that in terms of like prose anyway, I think it's really, really admirable, because I think I have to read a lot of children's books because I've got two young children. And there can be a tendency to over-explain all that stuff about show, don't tell. And it's like, I think that as a writer, when you're writing for adults, you got to trust your audience to go with you. You don't have to spell everything out all the time, I don't think. And if you do that, I think that you're probably doing it wrong. I think that when it comes to writing for kids, people kind of let that slide a little bit, and they think they have to keep doing that. And the fact that she didn't, and just allowed it to kind of flow as naturally as it did, and it's a wonderful book. I'd recommend it to anyone.
Yeah, that's interesting. I used to teach on an MA at Sheffield Hallam, an MA for writing for children, and I did a unit on their writing MA called Writing for Children. And it was always interesting to see. I mean, for a start, you've got some very, very bright people who'd come along, grown-ups who knew a lot and made my head spin sometimes. But one of the things I always used to do was take them to the children's library in Sheffield, just opposite near the Crucible, you know, that sort of around there somewhere. And I'd just say to the librarians, because librarians know ever such a lot about children's books, and I'd say to the children's librarians there, could you just take these people? It wasn't part of the course. They didn't have to come if they didn't want to, but they usually did. Just show them on the shelves, because they're all trying to write children's books. So just show them what the competition is, and just show them I'm going back a few years now, what is contemporary, you know. And I think the explosion that I mentioned in children's poetry in the 80s, chiefly through John Foster and through the wonderful Gabby Morgan and Macmillan's children's books, who just lit a fuse, and there were suddenly books for children's poetry everywhere. The same thing happened in fiction.
Yeah.
They're just huge. Some fantastic books for kids now.
Yes, and absolutely, and sort of not necessarily, and very much read by adults too.
Harry
Potter one is the obvious one, Philip Pullman, I recently read a book by Catherine Stord. Do you remember Catherine Stord?
Yeah.
Because Emma Storr, her daughter, is a poet who we have quite a bit to do with.
Oh, I see. Right.
And she gave me this. I didn't link Emma with Catherine. I knew of Catherine's work. But, Marianne Dreams. Do you know that?
No.
It's really interesting. That's great. I just read it as a novel, you know, just without really, it was just a book, you know, and didn't read it as children's fiction. I was totally gripped. And I thought, why don't I read more of this stuff? So I'm definitely the Sally Gardner I coriander.
I think she does write for adults as well, apparently, but when, I think she writes under a different name for adults, but her children's list is extensive. I just went out and bought like two or three more of them on spec because it's like... Mm. I'm a nerd for technique. It's like I can't switch my editor's head off when I'm reading to the point that it's annoying sometimes because I don't want to be a horribly critical reader. It's just my brain is always going, I'd scratch that adverb or whatever.
And I was reading it to
Keita and I just kept stopping and going like, just listen to
this. I wish you did there.
Just listen to this line and exactly. Can you see how this works? And so good. Fantastic. So good.
So, David, you've obviously, you know, it's not just children. We'll go back to I'd like to go back to children's writing, particularly how you get children to write, to develop as writers. But when I met you actually recently, you'd come in with Pennine Platform.
You had a
writer. Yeah. That wasn't a children's poem.
No, it was not a children's poem.
Have you got any poems with you that you haven't brought? I didn't ask you to bring those, did I?
I have on my laptop, which is in my bag, which is down there, which I would have to take a little while. But
well, in that case, why don't we have some music?
Yeah, okay.
And you can introduce that music and get some off your laptop.
I'm hoping this is Bob, the mighty Saint Bob of Dillon.
I understand that you're quite partial to a bit of Bob Dylan.
Well, yeah. What happened to us was that when our elder daughter, Lizzie, met her now husband, the wonderful Alex, came home one day and said, "Did you know, Mum and Dad, that Bob Dylan doesn't live in everybody else's house like he does in ours?" I said, "Really? Doesn't he?" Well, that's a shame, isn't it? Yeah, I got hit by Bob when I was about 10, I think, or 11.
Dylan and Dylan, isn't it?
Yeah, really? So all along, the reason is it's 1967. That's the first poem I ever had published in the school magazine. By that time, I was in Mexbury in South Yorkshire. Different planet, different place from Bromley. And getting understood was always... Well, I moved there in 1965. It took me 3 years to understand what everybody was saying. That's an exaggeration, but you know what I mean. I mean, can you imagine you're talking like that? And you go into a school and says, "All right, what's they got in the snap, Chase El Space?" I said, "What?" Yeah. I said, "What's they got in the snap?" So, but Mexford Grammar School had a school magazine and they published a poem of mine in 1967.
Right, and this is 1967, Bob Dylan, All Along the Watchtower.
There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it is worth. The thief he kindly spoke, there are many here among us who feel that life is but a joke. But you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate. So let us not talk falsely now, the hour is getting late. Kept the view while all the women came and went barefoot servants.
So that was...
That was All Along the Watchtower, followed by a reprise of I Want to Hold Your Hand. We're all deep in conversation here, and we completely forgot that we had to go on air again. Yeah. But David, just before you read a recent poem you've written, do you think something like getting published in the school magazine, how much did that mean to you at the time?
Oh, it meant a lot. It was great. Yeah. And it was, again, a great English teacher, John Fordham, who's still a friend, even though he's I haven't seen him for a while. He's very, very old.
John Fordham, it's not with jazz critic.
No. Just said, when I went from that poem into the sixth form, and he said, yes, I'll read, he said that fatal words to a 17-year-old earnestly writing about girls. I'll read your poems. Oh, bless him.
That's brilliant.
And that's, again, it's just often the people you meet, isn't it? And they just said, you're doing, these are all right, these, well, sort of. try reading this, and he just threw books at me, I was really lucky. In Mexico Grammar School, I was taught something or other, and the head of the grammar, the sixth form, was a man called Jack Fisher, and he taught Ted Hughes English. Because Ted Hughes lived in Mexico between 11 and 8, which in Mythenroyd they don't like to know about. But he did. And what Jack's, he would say to me, Harmer, my favourite youth, here's some money. Go over to Blinko's store now. This is the 1960s. Buy me 20 gold leaf, he said. And when you come back, I will tell you everything Edward and Sylvia spoke about the last time I met them. Edward and Sylvia, yes, all right. I want that. Yes, thank you. Wow. So it's just meeting teachers like that, isn't it, that sit on these roads.
Yeah. Great. Well, let's have a poem, David.
Okay, so this isn't a children's poem particularly. I just got this idea of combining sort of Greek things. You mentioned Ulysses, which I read once and didn't really understand, to be honest with you. And contemporary events. So I thought about the thing about Orpheus, who has to leave the underworld and it closes. If he turns round, is that right? If Orpheus leaves the underworld and if he turns round, it slams shut and isn't his wife or his daughter is on the other side. Yes. So I've combined that with... it's called Orpheus Outside Mamba's Mane, 1988. The pit gates swing open. The last shift leaves. Cleaned up and scrubbed from a final shower, he slowly walks towards Moor Bank, hair damp, shoulders under his T-shirt cut and striped with cold tattoos. His breath is heavy, years of bad air stack up in his lungs. And then there's the ache from Orgreave cracked ribs. The coppers fell on them like Peterloo dragoons. Long staves hammered any bit of a miner they could strike. Up the road, the scabs sat behind wired-up windows, eyes blank in gob-spattered buses, taking the plunge on full bellies, names forever sprayed onto walls, bridges, shop doorways. Face set forwards, he trudges up the lane where they'd marched back to work, their bright banners flared like the sails of a galleon adrift on treacherous waters. He'd played cornet in the brass band later, up at the welfare, wild on booze, they'd all sung the song he wrote for them, whooped their hearts out with pride for the colliery, sunk before the Great War, where generations chewed through its gut to an underworld where his mate saved him from the black dog's bite. He's nearly at the end of the street, takes one look behind, sees the pit gates slam shut. No going back, he's on his own.
That's brilliant.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I mean, it's very new, and as you could tell, I haven't read it out loud very many times.
Well, and also, it's the, if you're listening to this in 18 months' time or in 7 years' time, you will not know that today is this week, I think, is the 40th anniversary of the beginning of the miners' strike.
So when I was you're teaching in South Yorkshire during that, the Circus of Poets got stopped. We were driving in a van all the way down to Norwich to do a television thing, like one does, darling. And they were all on A1, just files of Metropolitan Police officers stopping you and accusing us of being flying pickets. And flying poets. It even said verse wagon on the side of the minibus we were in, it was just ridiculous. But it was intimidating and... Yes.
Absolutely. And Stu, we were talking about another writer from the north who wrote a lot about life in the north of England, J.B. Priestley. You're doing something about him at the moment?
It's a bit of a random one, really. I was rereading English Journey last week, and I put something on Twitter about it. And I was contacted by Luke Turner at the Quietus, and they're actually it's a music magazine, online music magazine that's been around for like 15 years, and they have a series of subscriber essays, and he said, could you do something about when my book was published, everyone, people compared it to Orwell, and a few people spoke about Jack London, although that was, you know, specifically about the homeless. And a few people mentioned like Mass Observation and things like that. No one mentioned J.B. Priestley, and even I hadn't noticed it. And I love J.B. Priestley, and I hadn't noticed the similarities between the two books. When he comes up north and he's saying, if I were to write this scene in a novel, people would speak of Dickens and accuse me of making it up, kind of thing. And so it's kind of looking at, it's looking at how relevant that book still is. And it's also kind of a piece about how overlooked he is as a writer. The only J.B. Priestley I knew for the longest time was an Inspector Calls, which people, it's still on the syllabus at school. And the first library that I worked in Leeds, Oakwood Library, we had a customer, Tony Patterson, I think his name was. He was obsessed with J.B. Priestley, and he kept talking about him. I was like, I wrote that boring like drawing room thing, didn't he? No, he was a great novelist, lad. You need to check some of this out. And when I started reading his novels, I've not read them all by any stretch, but I was amazed by how forward-thinking they are and how kind of fresh and how modern the prose is, considering how old they were. And then I started looking into a bit more about him, and it's like, wow, this guy founded CND with Bertrand Russell.
Did he?
He was a founding member of CND with Bertrand Russell. He did a weekly broadcast on the radio during World War II to the public, and Churchill cancelled it because he was getting 16 million viewers. And it's like, well, if you're winding Churchill up, that's usually a pretty good sign in my book, without going too far down that road. But so it's going to be a really, really nice piece to write, because he's just not a fashionable writer.
No.
And not that fashionable is important, but I think that somewhere there's a parallel universe where he's seen in this country as like a 20th century Dickens, and his novels are adapted for, you know, for TV every year by the Beeb.
So give us one that you particularly like, or two.
His novels, Lost Empires, is amazing. It's all about music halls and kind of magic shows and things like that.
Idea of that.
And he wrote an absolutely magnificent one called The Image Men, which is basically, I haven't seen this show, but a few years ago everyone was going crackers about an American TV show called Mad Men.
Yes,
Mad Men, yeah.
So the Image Men is essentially Mad Men, but written in England in the 60s. And I think the reason that he hasn't become that kind of Dickens figure, I think it's because he was so wide-ranging in what he wrote about that it's impossible for him to have that kind of brand in sort of modern parlance, where if you adapt a J.B. Priestley novel for the Beeb at Christmas, you kind of know what you're going to get, because you don't. They're all different, the thing that you're going to get, the writing will be fantastic, the characters will be vivid, the dialogue will be amazing, and as a technical piece of work, it will be brilliant, but the plots and the settings and the kind of messages of the books are wildly different, and I think that's why that hasn't happened.
Isn't that interesting how eclecticism and range counts against you? Wow, that's terrible.
Wow, yeah. I didn't know any of that. That's
no,
fantastic.
Nor did
Thank
I.
You.
I right
so much for telling us. That's,
That's
great.
I'm glad you came into this interview.
Yeah, I mean, I've read English Journey, but I haven't read anything else. Wow.
David, to go back to, and also
stupid thinking about the competition. I mean, you know, competitions are competitions, writing competitions, but they do encourage a lot of people, particularly young people, to take part and to actually get in, because people like to win things. So I'll come to you in a minute and I'll ask you about that. But David,
yes,
yeah, I mean, in terms of the workshops you do,
yes,
with children, how
and that it's the structure of them.
Yes, like. How do you get
it
the best
writing?
It
just so happens I brought along a book. It says November 06 to June 07, and it's full of what I did. And this is at Barden Juniors in Burnley. Yeah. Barden Juniors, fantastic little school. It was great. So I've got all the poems that I read out to them in the morning, which I noticed ended with a very fine poem of mine called Stinker Man, where I invented an anti-hero who smelt very badly. Stinker they used Man. To love that. Used to love that. And then I see from what I did was that they wanted me. They'd done a lot about UFOs. This was year six. So we did a big piece of paper, you know, this flip chart job, and because I don't see. When you go into a school, it doesn't matter how long you've been working in primary schools, I don't know their abilities. I don't know who they are. I don't know if they... You don't want some poor child saying, I can't write very well me. You want everybody to join in. So we used to make a big communal poem. I used to invent a chorus, something UFO, UFO, way up high, in the sky, UFO, and we all shout that out and say, verse one! What size is it? What shape is it? What colour is it? How fast is it? Trying to get similes all the time. It flies as fast as. It's as big as. It's as small as. It's just changed shape. It looks like. Second verse was, who's in it? So the aliens come out. And are they nice aliens or bad aliens? They always had to be bad aliens. They always had to zap you. I don't know. Perhaps that's just something about Burnley. I don't know. Size and shape. What noises? What do the aliens do? So the structure was, what's it look like from the outside? What's it look like from the inside? And finally, what happened next?
Yeah.
And they just shout stuff out. You just write it down. I think they write down. You just write it down in a line. It doesn't have to rhyme like that. And you say, right, there's four, and you make an even number of...
Writing on a board or on
a... Yeah, writing on a huge big flip chart with a very badly in capital letters with a felt pen.
Yes.
But what you're trying to say is, it's got a chorus, it's got a verse, the verse is about this. The verse has got four lines in it. Then there's a chorus. The second verse is about this. It's got four lines in it. The third verse is about this. It's got four lines in it. Right? Now, and here's... And then, it just always... Because every school's demands were different. Some just wanted you to belt through every class in the school to get the money's worth. Clever schools booked you for 3 days.
Yes.
other people just said, we're just going to work with year five today. And then we've got 3 year fives. And that's going to be enough, you know, session, morning session, blah, you see what I mean? So, but very often I would leave materials behind, so little frameworks for the teacher to follow up if they wanted to, and that would just develop the idea of that very simple structure. So you try to, the thing that most people find difficult about poetry is that it happens in lines. And so you've got to say to the children, and this little boy called Kevin once said to me, well, it's like a list, isn't it? I said, is it? He said, yeah, well, that's all poems, huh? I said, oh, your friend T.S. Eliot wrote some great lists, didn't he?
Shopping lists are
wonderful. Oh, wonderful. And I said, yes, it is. I said, it's just one line under another. And they had to get a sense of poetry. So I was trying to do ever such a lot at once and then leave something for them to follow up when the teacher thought it was appropriate. And then very often at the end of the day, particularly in the smaller schools, we'd all get together in the school hall and they'd all shout out their big poem. And if I'd worked with them, first of all, it was really slick. And if they were the ones I just finished with, they didn't know it was... I just had to hold it up and they'd shout it out, you know. And it was... So it's fun, but it's got a very simple structures.
I think you get that light bulb moment with kids as well when I've been doing it with mine at home and just explaining to them that when you read poetry out loud, you don't stop at the end of the line. And the expression on their faces, they're like, so that's what it is.
Yeah.
Because in their heads, it's going to be metrical and it's going to rhyme.
Yeah, but it doesn't.
And they've got it in their head that you've got like that, you've got the four-line structure, but it's going to be in couplets or... Yeah. Yeah. Whatever. So even if it's written in like blank verse, they're still stopping at the end of the line expecting it to follow that structure. And when you just say, look, follow the punctuation, not the not the lines.
Yes.
It's just little things, isn't it? Like that.
Yeah, his kids are gonna be like doing an English literature degrees by the age of 15.
No, that's really good. That's really interesting though. So that's what I tried to do, and I tried to make it fun.
Yeah.
And they'd all say you're daft, you.
Yes.
And then, of course, inevitably, have you got any questions? Which is great when you ask that of reception, because you've done all that for 15, 20 minutes and they've all made up a poem about a dinosaur between you all, and you've taught them a poem about a dinosaur, and you say, any questions? They go, yes, have you got any fish? My dad's got a fridge, because they're only five. I always used to think that reception classes should be on the National Health, you know. If you ever want to meet a whole bunch of crazy surrealists who are going to make you laugh, just go into any reception class. Yeah. And just ask them a question. They go, I like you, you're daft. It's great.
It really keeps you on your toes, doesn't it? With it, when I first started having to do things like that with work and going to speak to school assemblies and stuff, it absolutely terrified me because I didn't have any experience of public speaking and stuff. This is like 15 years ago. A couple of years of it, and I loved it.
They're great, aren't they?
Rock up. You've got absolutely, you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
That's fine, but you can't legislate for what they're going to throw at you.
No.
And you've got to be on the ball all the time. It's great fun.
And then right at the back, because they always sit in a line, in lines in front of you. And then right at the back, you've got year six, who are too cool for school because they're just you know. And taking the mickey out of them is a delight. In a nice way. I'm not being, not to be mean,
No. John Hegley's come here a few times and does stuff.
Well, there you are.
He does some lovely work in primary school. Yes. When I took him into Beechwood School, I didn't know how he would go because John is, and you probably know him, but he's just himself. He doesn't try. I think some writers, when they go into school, say feel they need to be kind of teachers or in a way to imitate the kind of the teacher's mien. Mm. But John just talked in front of the assembly, just talked like very quietly, a bit like that, you know. And I thought, well, how's this going to go? But he involved the teachers, and by the end of it, of course, they were all eating out of his hand. It was really, real, a real masterclass, actually, to be honest with you. As I'm sure it would be.
Oh, well, of course. Yeah. But anyway, so that's what I tried to do. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, it does. That's really interesting. And I love to see that you've got a notebook with writing in it for your structures. I still, but if I do it like, you know, I mean, my session plans, which I now have been in Leeds East.
Analog,
analog, handwriting. Yeah. We haven't got too much longer left, but I'd like to hear some more poems from you, David. So while you're looking up your poems, Stu, you are now buying books for Leeds libraries as well as doing obviously your own writing.
Yeah,
what's it like to be the person who buys books for a library in a city?
It's pretty cool, really. We've got 34 libraries in Leeds, and obviously the communities are really, really, really diverse. I think the nicest thing about it has been kind of having the opportunity to diversify the stock, I suppose, not just in terms of different kind of cultures and voices to be represented, but a lot more. I've been able to start buying a lot more small press stock and just cut back a little bit on some of the really, really big sellers. So we've still got lots and lots and lots of them. But the smaller publishers that don't get the press coverage and they don't get the shelf space in Waterstones and stuff,
that's good.
You put that in front of people and they absolutely love it. And when you can give them a publisher like, Blue Moose is a really good example, you know, because they publish really accessible, you know, well-written fiction, and there are people who will buy every book they put out because it's got a Blue Moose on the spine. Mm. When you can introduce a customer to something like that and they go, oh my God, this book's amazing, and you can say, well, they published three others by the same person and they've got a 15-year backlist to explore, it's great. And it's really, really nice to be able to introduce people to new things and kind of broaden the horizons, and that's what I like to do. That's why I do the job that I do, and that's why I kind of write, you know.
I'm glad you're buying the books for Leeds. Fantastic. That's really good to hear it. And just briefly, I mean, the only thing about the buying of the books is that I grieve for the books that the libraries throw out or get rid of. Do you know Norman Nicholson, the very wonderful poet? And I remember finding his autobiography called Wednesday Early Closing, it's called, but in the business section, because somebody thought it was about commercial stuff, and it hadn't been borrowed since about 1983, and I just thought,
That's for the chop. So that worries me. But do you do that as well?
The way that I kind of explain it to people is that there is no one who likes getting rid of books. But if you think that, without talking about budgets and stuff, but if you've got X number of books coming into the system every year, it's a gross oversimplification, but you have to get rid of the same amount of books just to maintain a static stock size. And there are lots and lots and lots of criteria that we use. People drop them in the bath, they get curry on them and things like that. They get chewed by dogs, they get chewed by children. There are all sorts of things that we can use to justify it. No one wants to do it, but it is just an inevitable part of the process. And I think that when we do have to get rid of them, we're replacing them with really, really great stuff. And as long as we can keep doing that, I think that the jobs are good.
Don't you sell them? I used to buy lots of books at library sales.
They do sell them off sometimes, yeah. It kind of varies from site to site. And again, if it's been dropped in the bath or child chewed, then you probably don't want to buy it. I could write a whole book about things that I've found in library books, but most of them aren't repeatable on the radio, yeah. So we won't go down that one.
Was it Joe Orton who used to go to the library and steal the last page?
Yes, he did. Didn't they? Him and who's Kenneth Halliwell used to take headlines from the titles of books and then put them with photographs and the wrong things. So they had a headline, I think, about three people falling off a cliff. So it was four cling to cliff all night, and then they put a photograph of Cliff Richard underneath. But it was stuff like that. And they actually had a prison sentence for
they
that.
They did. Oh, yeah, I think so.
Anyway, is that what he was in prison for? Jim?
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah,
defacing library books.
Wow. Yeah.
There you go. But David, it's thank you for generously sharing the pod here.
Thank you. I've kind of crushed your thunder a bit.
I know, it doesn't matter, darling. As long as the fee's in the pot. No, it's fine, it's great.
You come on again, I hope. Have you got something at the moment that we need to hear about that you're working on
Well, I'm always writing poems for grown-ups. I've just sent some poems off. Macmillan's these days don't do all these little ones. They do these enormous ones. Like this one I'm very proud of, because this is the big, amazing poetry book celebrating 30 years of Macmillan's. And I've got several poems in that.
Lovely.
And they're doing a big one about myths and legends as well.
Great.
Yeah.
Lovely stuff.
I've got a serious poem.
Yep. Read a serious poem to finish off with a big
one. Okay. It's called Daytime Moon. Today we were driving home from seeing our grandpa and grandma on the other side of town, and it was still bright daylight, even though it was late, almost bedtime, and I looked out of the car and suddenly saw a small, pale moon staring down at me through silver clouds, and where the jet planes had scratched deep smoky plumes through the blue. I turned to tell my mum, but she was falling asleep. My dad was busy driving and telling my little sister to stop going on about princesses and unicorns, not to mention pink ponies and all that rubbish. His words, not mine. So finally it was just me and the moon looking at each other. I poked mum quite hard, but by the time she'd finished saying, "What?" the shiny moon had gone.
Lovely stuff. Thank you very much, David. And finally, you've got and one more piece of music, which is by the Young Fathers. So tell us about that.
Well, it's because I really like it, and my Paul and I really like it, and it's because it's a sort of stuff. And I'm so the pieces of music have been stages, and I'm still writing poems. Let's listen to people making great music now.
This is the Young Fathers with, and what's the title of the track?
I think it's called I Know, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. Well, thanks ever so much, David, for coming
great.
On.
I've really enjoyed it. It's been great to meet you, Stu. It's been fun.
Yeah, you too. Thanks for having us.
We'll see you next week at the meeting you were supposed to be at today.
Yeah, hopefully.
I've got that in my diary.
Yeah, you can join us for that one.
Yeah, you can join us too. Sorry. It might not be too interesting for you. So, yeah, thank you to Agnes and thanks to Jake, who's apprentice on the desk there. Let's see. Hear some Young Fathers.
I want your shield, I want your weapon. Give me that bulletproof vest. And don't forget, I'm not susceptible to your nonsense. I'm a winner. No falling for your charms, no crashing to your arms. Handful of coins and a bold of fist. Speaking early. Clean your. If I see a rotten apple,
spread the word. Mark my words. Love the words. On East Leeds Community Radio.
Nothing compares to